This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Women began shifting their focus from the home to careers years ago. Doing so launched a progression of changes in the home and the workplace and, of course, in the lives of women. Today, there are more women in school than men. This year, women became the majority of the workforce for the first time in history. And of the 15 job categories projected to grow the most in the next decade in the United States, all but two are occupied primarily by women. Perhaps that's why women's issues have surged to the forefront in this election year. The odd thing is, the issues being discussed were thought by many women to have been settled years ago. Elisa Chappelle is a contributing editor and hot type book columnist at Vanity Fair and the author of Blueprints for Building Better Girls. She writes about in Four Women, and she joins us for the hour. In advance of her appearance this Friday at the Charlotte Parent Moms at Work breakfast at the Charlotte Convention Center, for which we have information at our website, WFAE.org. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, in the promos, we've been calling you Elisa Chappelle because it's E-L-I-S-S-A, but it's not Elisa, it's Elisa.
It's Elisa, yes.
Why?
Well, my father was a chemist, and my mother was a caterer and a painter, and I think something about that extra S just appealed to them, perhaps my mother aesthetically, and perhaps my father was, I don't know, making up some new chemical element in his mind.
Well, I'm glad we got it right. I know that you
Me
come.
Too.
I know that you come to town. Relatively frequently, because you are you teach at Queens, don't you?
I do. I love it. Yes, I teach in the low residency MFA program there, and it's a lot of fun. A lot of great students, and I really appreciate it. Coming from the East Coast, it's nice to go to a new part of the country and meet new people, and everybody has slightly different stories. So it's been it's been really rewarding for me and a lot of fun.
I know that you have a pretty varied career. You are, as we just said, you teach creative writing. You majored in creative writing. You are an editor. You help publish magazines, help edit magazines, and you're an author in your own right. And you write a lot about and you speak a lot about women's issues. Would you say that you have crafted a career around those issues, or is that just a tiny portion of what you see yourself as doing?
That's really a good question. I would say that despite the fact that I would never, certainly growing up, ever have called myself a feminist, because in my mind that, you know, a feminist was someone who didn't wear a bra and had hairy armpits and was always screaming in men's faces, I have always been a feminist. And I think the older that I have gotten, the more comfortable I am with myself and the more I know about the world. Certainly the older we get, we learn so much. So I think as I've gotten older, and also I have a voice, I have a platform. Mm-hmm. I feel that I have a responsibility to talk about women's issues, and I'm passionate about them. But I wouldn't say that I was always wired that way. In fact, growing up, most of my, you know, dear friends were men. And so I never thought of myself as being like a quote unquote girl's girl, like a, you know, like a, what are the fried green tomatoes girl, or one of those chick lit books. I just always thought of myself as just a woman, and a complicated woman.
Given what you write about and the frequency that you talk about this and the interest that you have personally in it, does it surprise you some of the issues that have been cropping up in this political season with regard to women?
Oh, heavy sigh, heavy sigh. I think that the war on women this year, I guess, well, actually it started 4 years ago when the GOP said everything that Obama wants, we're just going to shut him down, every single thing. And some of that stuff, a lot of that stuff was legislation to help families, for economic equality. And those are women's issues, family issues, economic equality. You know, women make 70 cents to every dollar that the man makes. And so I think that in a way I've become very tuned into what's going on politically, in part because, look, I have a family. I want to make as much money as my male counterparts. And in terms of the social issues, like you were saying earlier, it's just astonishing to me. I'm gobsmacked at the fact that we are being pushed back into the dark ages. I was young for, you know, the whole women's lib movement. I certainly was aware of it because I was growing up in the 70s. But the idea that all those hard-fought-for opportunities and rights are being rolled back is just unbelievable to me. I feel like at some point they're going to show up and break my glasses and take away my library card. I think it's really, really alarming. I do. I am genuinely alarmed and feel very vigilant about protecting the rights of women. And not just because I have a daughter and not just because I've got lots of friends who have daughters, and I have a sister and I have a mother, and I feel very connected to my community. These are human issues, especially the economic stuff. These are issues that affect everyone, but really hit women where they live, as it were.
You use the term war on women, which has been used before by other people in other settings. But do you think there really is a war on women? Because we also have these wars on religion and wars on values and wars on
drugs.
I
absolutely agree. I think it's an overused word, and I'd like to find a better, more evocative term. But I think any time a group of people seek to control the body of another human being, make decisions that are all about controlling that person's reproductive rights, that to me feels like war. That to me is not, we're just going to try and manipulate you, or we're going to try and just put our laws on your body. We want to get inside your body. And I think some of what is so appalling to me is the hypocrisy. A lot of these people want there to be no government, government out of my life. Keep your laws out of my house. Give me my guns, and yet they have their hand in my pants. That to me, that kind of hypocrisy is not acceptable. And to compare women having, women being pregnant and having children to livestock, if a woman suffers, just the worst thing in the world is carrying a child that is no longer alive. The idea that woman can't get an abortion but must carry that child to term, to me, is torture, is literally torture. And that, to me, feels like war.
Mm-hmm. There are those who would say that this business of conservatives wanting the government out of their personal lives, and yet they want the government involved in morality issues, is something that goes beyond women. It goes into a lot of different areas. Why do you think there is that disconnect? Why do those people who favor smaller government and freedom from government want government involved in these other issues?
You know what? That is a really, really good question. And I don't have a good answer, except for the fact that I think that maybe they're seeing you're talking about the rise of women in the workplace and the rise of minorities. I think some of it is fear of wanting to hold on to the power that they have historically always had. They've always been the power party. I think some of it is fear. I think there is some sort of paranoia that if women can we don't really need men except that we love men and want men in our lives, but a woman can give birth. A woman can protect the cave. A woman can make money. And if a woman can do all those things, I think that there are some men who feel really threatened by that, and so they seek to control them. And it's a way, at a time when they're losing power, to feel like they are gaining power. And in fact, they are. But it's not just men, I should point out. There are many female lawmakers and governors like Jan Brewer in Arizona who are also pushing these laws and, creating all this legislation to control women's rights to reproductive, health services and Planned Parenthood. And that, to me, is particularly sad because that really hits poor women and young women harder than it does upper middle class women, because that's where people go to get education. That's where people go to get their cancer screenings. And yes, some people go there to get birth control. A minute portion of the women that actually go to Planned Parenthood go there for abortions. And I should say that I think abortion is terribly sad, and I am not someone who doesn't think one of these people who says, women should have as many abortions as they want. I think every single time it's got to be a tragedy and it's heartbreaking. And for heaven's sakes, nobody wants an abortion. But in the case where someone feels like really they know they cannot take care of this child, or they really do not want this child, or this child has come about because they have been raped or a victim of incest, I don't believe that anyone has the right to tell that woman she must carry that child to term. And there's this argument that, well, there are all these people that want to adopt babies. And, you know, you have the child and you will learn to love it and God will make room in your life and you will be able to raise them. Well, there's all this care for the unborn fetus. But when the child is actually born, you know, the GOP wants to wipe out half of the health programs that help support, you know, working mothers and poor mothers and single mothers. And that it makes no sense to me.
Elisa Chappell is our guest today. She's with Vanity Fair, contributing editor there, also the co-founder and editor-at-large of Tin House Magazine, and the author of Blueprints for Building Better Girls, about which we'll talk in a little while. She's going to be speaking on Friday at the Charlotte Convention Center for Charlotte Parrot Magazine. When the Women's Lib movement was being established and a lot of new ground started being broken, women said they wanted it all. In fact, you say that your generation was raised to believe that women can have it all. You pushed the envelope further by saying you were raised to believe not only that having it all was possible, but that you must also be it all to all people, wife, mother, daughter, sister, friend, community member. And you say, we can't. Isn't that a bit of a heresy?
Well, I think, no, it's just reality. I think, you know, we talk about how more and more women are entering the workplace and ascending in the ranks. And unfortunately, despite the fact that there is a rise of husbands who are becoming equal parents, and I was very lucky in that I have a husband who's a great partner and certainly equally has raised our children. For the majority of women, they still do all the housework. They still do all of the emotional taking care of the family, you know, the husband, the children. And they're also, a lot of them, caring for their parents increasingly as our parents get older. They're doing a full-time job in a workplace, and they're still doing the stuff that they've always traditionally done. And I don't think that you can do that at the same level. You can't go and, in my experience, work an 8-hour day, delegate, be powerful, and then come home and do the same thing. Because what we find is that women who have an easy time delegating at work have a much harder time delegating at home. And some of that, I think, is due to these traditional role models that we've grown up with. You know, a good mother shouldn't ask her husband to give the kids a bath and put them to bed. Or certainly they can't get themselves to bed. They have to, you know, they need their mother for that. And so we end up being absolutely overburdened. It's very hard sometimes, I think, for women to even find themselves that that part of their identity that isn't a mother or isn't a wife, because there's so little time for reflection. So I do realize that it is heresy. And I know that I go even further when I say, if you're going to do one thing really, really well, understand you're not going to do everything else really, really well. Hmm. You know, in my case, I'm a writer, and that's what I do. If you come to my house is not perfect. I can assure you, if you put a stick under the sofa, you will find some dust bunnies. But some of that's priorities too. What's important to me is that I make the best art I can possibly make and be the best parent that I can be and wife, not housekeeping.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back with more with Elisa Chappell. And I want to talk about this. I mean, when the women's movement began and women began taking jobs outside the home, there was this guilt factor probably in making them want to be good wives and mothers while they were good workers as well. Is that at all diminishing? We'll get an answer to that when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Elisa Chappell is our guest, contributing editor and hot type book columnist for Vanity Fair, author of Blueprints for Building Better Girls. She will be speaking at the Charlotte Convention Center Moms at Work Breakfast for Charlotte Parent Magazine on Friday, and also at 3 o'clock in Kettner Auditorium in the Sykes Learning Center at Queen's University of Charlotte. She'll be talking as well. They have her busy when she's in town. Let's talk about that question about when women first went out to the workforce, they felt that they had to be everything, and they could have it all, they could do it all. And a lot of that, I would think, was because they didn't want to abandon what had been traditional roles or being accused of abandoning those things. But as the last 30, 40 years have gone on, is there less pressure now to be all things all the time?
Huh, that is a good question. I would say that perhaps there is less pressure. I think something that is unfortunate is that, you know, feminism was all about giving women choices. All women should be equal. Women should have choices. And one of the choices that isn't valued by a lot of women, I think, is women who choose not to go back to work or to enter the workforce. I have a little bit of a problem with that in some way women are stigmatized if they choose to stay home. In terms of guilt, I think there is a lot of guilt. We're expected to do all these things. You know, in my book, Blueprints for Building Better Girls, that's one of the things that I really was interested in writing about, was writing about the ways that and I don't like to preach. I mean, I feel like when I'm on Facebook and when I'm talking to you, sometimes I'm preaching. I think sometimes a better way to get your messages in there is through writing fiction and writing these stories. One of the things I really wanted to address was the kind of guilt that women do in fact feel for not being able to be everything, or the guilt they feel for being feeling resentful, perhaps, that when they want to go back to work, they don't get support. That there are people who are saying, why do you need to go back to work? Your identity should be as a wife and mother, when really it's much more complicated than that. So I think the guilt works in both directions.
So you reached the conclusion that you can't have it all, and that if you and if you're going to go and do something, do one thing really, really well and let some of the other things slide. You can't be the only woman in the world who has reached that conclusion. So when women do reach that conclusion or come to that realization, how does it affect them?
Well, I think a lot of women simply don't want to believe that, and I know a lot of young women are troubled by that. I have a 17-year-old daughter, and I said this in front of her, and she said, well, that's terrible. How can you say that? Of course we can have it all. And I said, well, yes, you can have it all, but if you really want to do something at a high level, if it's your passion, if you feel passionately about something outside of you know, being a wife and mother or being, you know, any kind of partner, it's simply not possible because a lot of your energy is going to go into your passion. And that is a place where your identity is really going to be formed in addition to being a wife and mother. But not every woman feels like the first thing that she would put on her life resume is wife, mother, business executive. She might lead with, you know, business executive, wife and mother. I remember my daughter when she was maybe 5 years old asking me, what's more important to you, mommy, being a wife or what's more important to you, being a writer or being a mother? And I was quite taken aback. And it took me a moment to really register what she was asking me because I felt guilty because I figured that this meant that she had picked up in some way on some sort of ambivalence I might have had sometimes about having had a child. That was this really the best thing for me to do if I wanted to be an artist? Because there is the idea in the literary community, well, actually in the whole arts community, that women who become artists or writers and have children simply aren't as serious as their male counterparts. And what I said to her was, I've been a writer my whole life. It's the only thing I've ever done. It's who I am. And I've only been your mom for 5 years. But I can tell you that there's no job in the world as important to me as being your mother. But it really pointed up for me that, you know, there is a real push and pull there. And it's hard for women, I think, sometimes to feel good about the choices that they've made, whether it is staying home to be a stay-at-home mother or going back to work or, you know, just exploring a new path. There's a lot of guilt in that.
In some of your writing, you suggest that women forgive themselves for not being good at everything. But you also point out elsewhere that people are judging you. So how do you forgive yourself when others don't or won't?
Well, I think that something that we do, and I think a lot of women do this, is we give our power away. You know, the number one way that people lose power is by giving it away. And I think we let people tell us who we are because that's the way we've been raised. Our parents, the culture tells us who we are. You know, the book has a title that's a play on an etiquette book because etiquette books are all about laying out the rules, telling us what the culture values and the cost of not behaving the way that the culture wants you to behave. And I think that kind of punishment and that kind of judgment is wrong. And I think that women really need to, in a way, I mean, this sounds kind of incendiary, but rise up and say, that's not okay with me anymore.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I was just going to say, does that judgment come from other women, or does it come from men, or is it equally divided among the two?
I think that sometimes the harshest critics of women are other women. Really, no, women know how to take each other apart much better than men do. While we're talking on a grand scale politically, those are the majority of those people trying to take away women's rights, or men. But on a more intimate level, a lot of the criticism is coming from women. We judge each other. We undermine each other. And we're really good at that because women, you know, the way that women's friendships are different than men's friendships. Women bond over shared information. They're very intimate with each other. They tell each other things that they wouldn't tell a partner or a husband or someone they're having sex with. And oftentimes the times that women bond are in these transitional life moments, when they go to college, when they become mothers, when they become wives, when they go to work. And these are times of stress. And so they're times when we really invest a lot of emotional energy and a lot of our feelings in other women. And so we have a lot of power in that way. We really have the ability to hurt each other in a way that other people don't.
Yeah, you say that female friendships are far more complex than even the romantic relationships we have with men. This is a quote. We give each other an awful lot of information about ourselves. We know where each other's soft spots are, making us uniquely equipped to damage each other. Now, other women have recognized that statement as being true. So what are you saying here, that women shouldn't bond?
No, absolutely not. We all need those intimate, close relationships. Part of the reason that men remarry so quickly is because men need to be able to have people to talk to and to really share that, you know, that intense emotional, psychological information with. And they don't do it with other men. You know, men bond over shared activities. But we need – men and women need that kind of connection. I think what's different in women's cases is that the idea of, you know, female friendships have become so idealized and romanticized from the time that we're little, we're signing our letters, you know, BFF. You have to have a best friend, and that best friend has to be forever. And women's relationships are supposed to be, you know, men leave, but your female gal pals will always be there for you. And the reality is that female friendships are like any kind of relationship. Some of them have a real shelf life. And when you have two people who have a lot of power and a lot of information about each other and are very emotional, not every friendship is going to last, nor should it last, right? But there's an awful lot of guilt that goes along with that because women are told that we need to have best friends and be good friends. I edited an anthology about this called The Friend Who Got Away, and it was really interesting. When we were approaching women about contributing to the book, everybody had a story. Almost everybody that we asked got teary, and half of them, after committing, said, you know what, I actually can't do this. I feel too naked. I'll write about my sex life. I'll write about my drug addiction. I'll write about being bankrupt. But I cannot write about this friendship because it still pains me so much. And I think there's a lot of guilt in that. We don't want to be seen as being a bad friend. Presenting ourselves to a new friend as someone who has lost a friend immediately sends up a red flag. Well, what did she do to lose this friendship? Or perhaps she can't be trusted. And we don't talk about it. We go to therapy with people who we've been sleeping with, but don't have that same kind of emotional bond with. There's no kind of therapy for friends to go and hit each other with foam bats, right? And so when you lose a friend, you can't talk about it. It's intensely painful. It could have been closer than any other relationship in your life. So it's like someone has died, but there's no body to mourn. And it's a really deep secret pain, and we don't talk about it, which is one of the reasons that I felt so strongly about emphasizing some of the female friendships in this book, because I thought this is something we don't talk about. And I have always felt that my job as a writer is to write about the things that we all know, these experiences that we share but we don't like to talk about, either because we find it difficult to articulate the experience or because we find it shameful, or because it doesn't seem like the sort of thing that one should talk about, to borrow Emily Post's language. Mm. In any case, these experiences that that make us uncomfortable. And for me, writing is about making people less lonely and telling the truth. So I felt really committed to this book to write the truth about females' friendships. So
that book is Blueprints for Building Better Girls. We'll talk about that in a second here. But I want to go back to Having It All, because Jennifer in Charlotte is on the phone and wants to share a story about that. Jennifer, you're on with Elisa Chappelle. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I also teach at Queens, so I thought I probably better say that up front. I really, really love this conversation. I'm constantly talking to my girlfriends about this very same thing. And I also grew up in this sort of time frame with a single mom who was staunchly feminist. I remember growing up and having in our ERA signs all around the house, and growing up and believing, yeah, you can have it all just not at the same time. That was the sort of hard lesson that I learned. And I am now, yeah, I find myself now as a single mom of three boys, and I think part of the conversation is that we're missing out half of the equation, because it can't just be talking to our girls, but talking to our boys, too, about the same thing. I really kind of come down on them pretty hard when they say things that I find sexist or a little off color, just because it's what they picked up in the schoolyard, and I'm just trying not to reinforce these same stereotypes for them in terms of women, but also in terms of them, that they are allowed to be vulnerable, that they are allowed to have multiple identities, and that they don't have to just walk lockstep in, this is what it means to be a man.
I salute you. I think that is I think that is so important. I also have a son, and while sometimes he will joke, can we please talk about something other than feminism at dinner? You know, feminists aren't women. Feminists are anybody who thinks that women deserve equal rights.
Right.
You know, that isn't anti-female. And
right.
We must be raising sensitive boys because I love my son. They're half the population.
Right.
And I think to just assume, or just to kind of write them off as, well, they're going to be boorish, or this is sexism and everybody's sexist, is not true. We learn these behaviors. Not every culture behaves the way that we do.
Exactly.
And I think especially with the rise in the sexualization of young women and all the stuff they're exposed to on the internet, it's really easy for them to get desensitized. And I think
Sure. What
you're doing is so important, calling out people, our sons, other people, when there are instances of sexism or violence against women, because these are human issues. They're not just female issues. They're human issues. It's about
Right. Dignity.
It's about respect. And I think that's a great thing you're doing.
Well, thanks. Well, at any rate, love the conversation.
Thank you for your call, Jennifer. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Your books, Use Me and then Blueprints for Building Better Girls, use a series of interconnected stories to make your points. They aren't novels, but stories in which various characters know some of the other various characters. What does this form allow you to do that you couldn't do in a novel?
Well, you know, I think of the books actually as being a novel in stories, because they are linked thematically and the characters do appear in each other's stories. So while it is not a traditional novel set in one place, moving with only one cast of characters through one narrative trajectory, I do think of it as a novel in stories. And the variety of points of view that I get to use allow the reader to get intimate knowledge about each character. So we see them, their interior state, how they perceive their life, but then we also get to see them through the perspective of other people. So we get to see the persona they present. And by doing this, the reader develops certain kinds of biases or prejudices. Perhaps the first time they meet a character, they say, oh my goodness, well, I just saw her as a slut behaving in this way. And I don't approve of that. And then you see in another story that, you know, that she isn't at all the person that we think she is. And we have a very different take on her then. So I really thought that it was important to talk about one of the themes of the book being the way that we judge each other without even knowing each other. You can look around a room and say, well, that person isn't for me and that person isn't for me. And therefore, you never get to know them. And were you to spend the time getting to know them, not judging them, you know, that could be someone that might save you. So it was important for me to challenge the reader to confront why they made some of the judgments about the characters that they did early on, mm-hmm. but also to give you the – to mimic that experience of how we meet someone and we form an opinion of them, or we go to college with them and we have a memory of this person. So they live outside our memory in a way that isn't who they ultimately are later when they grow up. There's a story in the book about a young woman who's a party girl, and everyone sees her simply as this kind of empty party girl, when in fact she has she's very sensitive and she is deep. But people who leave school will only think of her in this one way. She will be this cliche. She will be you know, like something out of a, you know, she's like a mythological beast in a way. So I wanted to talk about the way that we live in each other's imaginations and the way that certain people connect us without us even knowing it necessarily. So I would argue that in a way they do work as a novel. Okay. You just, the reader has to do a lot of work.
You put these, you purposefully point out the characteristics of these women, the slut, good wife, the good mom, the bad wife, the party girl, the anorexic, etc.
Yes.
And point out that these people are not the sum and substance of those labels. They are far more than that. And I know the argument you're making is that none of us are like that. We may get prior pigeonholed or label, but we're not necessarily that label. But how do we see beyond that shorthand?
That's a really good question. Part of why I wanted to write this book, and part of the reason that it's structured the way that it is, the idea of it kind of being an anti-etiquette book, you know, etiquette books tell us how to behave, and again, like what the culture values. But as far, you know, these are archetypal characters, and I wanted to turn them on their ear. I wanted you to recognize these women and then be told who they really are inside.
Let's stop and come back on the other side with more about that. Elisa Chappell is our guest, and we're talking about her book, Blueprints for Building Better Girls. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Elisa Chappell is our guest, contributing editor and hot type book columnist to Vanity Fair, co-founder, editor-at-large of Tin House Magazine, author of Blueprints for Building Better Girls. She's speaking at the Moms at Work breakfast for Charlotte Parent Magazine on Friday at the Convention Center and on Friday afternoon at Kettner Auditorium at the Sykes Learning Center at Queen's University of Charlotte, where she also is an instructor, a low residency MFA program at Queen's University. You say that readers can see ways in which these characters in this book, these prototypical characters, the slut, the bad wife, good mom, party girl, anorexic, in your book, Blueprints for Building Better Girls, that these that readers can see ways in which these characters and their various labels didn't, if they didn't judge each other, they might connect with each other. And you also look at the cost of not connecting, not doing so. Do women put each other into these categories more than men?
No, I don't think so. I don't think more than men. I think a lot of these archetypal characters have been, not dreamed up by men, but certainly reinforced by men. If you look at men's fiction, you will find that a lot of the women characters, or maybe it's not fair to say a lot of the women characters, I'm thinking about in Updike and Roth, the women characters aren't nearly as rich and complicated as the male characters. And I think that that certainly reinforces the idea that women are these archetypal characters, you know, good, like you were saying, the good wife, the bad wife. And for me, the fastest way you rob someone of their power is by stereotyping them, by telling them who they are, and that removes all their power. They're one thing. They're not this wonderful, multifaceted creature. So that to me is a way that we are robbed of power. And I don't think it's just women doing this. I think it's women and men. It's the culture as a whole. It happens in the media. It happens, in the way that in the products that were sold. It's very insidious. And it's really it's causing terrible harm.
And don't we
for
do
women
this,
and men?
And don't we do this? Don't men do it too? I mean, there's the playboy, the jock, ladies' man, whatever you want to call it.
Right, right. I think yes. You mean in terms of labeling?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I think that in the first story, Monsters of the Deep, the young woman who has been labeled a slut, despite the fact that she isn't a slut, there's just always has to be a woman where everybody projects all their sexual frustration. You know, she has to be a repository for all that ugly sexual energy. He was the fat boy, and he has not been able to transcend that. So what he does is he becomes a wrestler. He becomes a jock, and still, despite the fact that he's a really good wrestler, he has an eating disorder, which is surprising because we don't talk about eating disorders with boys. He can't get away from that core message that he got from the culture, which is if you're fat, you are weak. And if you're weak, you are not masculine. And if you are not masculine, then we will treat you like a girl. We will treat you hostily because you make us uncomfortable. So I think that it cuts both ways.
So aside from pointing out what we're missing by relying on these labels to identify the other people in our lives, what do we do about it?
Well, I think what we do, if you're a writer, you want to write books that tell you what you don't know about the people that you think you know, right? I think some of it is about being more curious. It's about realizing that there's an enormous part of the population that the culture just ignores. As soon as a woman has a child and becomes a quote unquote soccer mom, a term that I really despise, I think it is so dismissive and so insulting in some ways. Because it just says, okay, you know what? As a soccer mom now, you're no longer an environmentalist. You're no longer a skater. You're no longer a thinker. You're no longer a sexual creature, which is really funny because women hit their sexual peak in their 40s. And yet to a large part of the population, they become invisible. I know that since having a child, two children, and having these experiences as a mother, I'm a far more passionate and dangerous person than I was before this. And the fact that we're, you know, this labeling, all it does is serve to pulls out women's claws and teeth and puts them in little boxes and shuts those boxes. And women are starting, I think, to push against those boxes and say, you know what, I am much more than just this good mother. And the cost of just being a good mother is not acceptable to me. That to me is what's really needs to happen here. But some of that has to come from women. It's not simply the culture. Women have to demand to be seen in ways that are different than the stereotypical ways. It makes me think about maternal leave, right? Because historically the workplace has been controlled by men, but now that women are taking over the workplace, those rules should be changed. Hmm. Why just assume that those rules that were set up by the, you know, patriarchy are the rules that we should continue to follow? We need to remake the world in our image.
What do you mean when you say you're more dangerous than you used to be?
I think that becoming a mother has made me realize that I am fiercely there are things that I feel really fiercely about and that I have a moral responsibility to address. And some of that is equal rights for women and girls. And in that way, I think once you're fired by passion and once you're unafraid to speak about what you truly feel, you become dangerous to the culture. It's funny, in the New York Times review of my book, the first line was, you know, danger, these women are under pressure, they're toxic, and they're dangerous. And I was thinking, well, in what way are they dangerous? All I'm doing is telling you what you don't know about ordinary women. These are stories that women relate to, and I don't understand exactly why we see them as dangerous. But I do feel that I no longer care what people think about me. I have the power of my convictions. I'm loved by the people I want to be loved by. And so I feel like I have a moral responsibility to say the things that nobody wants to say.
Well, you say that as a writer, your job is to say the thing everyone knows is true but no one wants to say because they can't articulate it, or it's too dangerous, or it's simply not done.
Exactly. And I can't tell you how many people come up to me and say, I can't believe you wrote about rape. And I can't believe that you wrote about it in a way that really speaks to me. One of the stories, a young woman is raped, and the story isn't about the rape so much as it is about how she's trying to protect her parents from her pain. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows what happened, but nobody can talk about it. And in fact, the only person that she can tell that this happened to her is her grandfather, who has dementia. He's the one person who will forget. But she needs to tell someone. And all of the stories in this book, I hope, are powered by that energy. Every single one of the women in these stories has to tell her story. Her voice is really important. She's at a moment of crisis in her life, and she needs to tell you her story. And it's not necessarily a big story, but it is one of those moments in our lives that we look back at and think, that was a moment of true feeling, or that was a turning point for me. That's what I'm interested in.
Okay. I want to share a couple of interesting questions and comments that have come in while we've been talking on email. First one from Rita. I wanted to add, she says, that just as women's friendships may have a shelf life, so do marriages and partnerships with men or lovers or whatever. I've counseled many women who feel deeply hurt and feel that they are failures because their husband or boyfriend has broken off the relationship, pointing out that most relationships are not intended to last forever, that they add to our life experience, make use of who we are, and that most of the time people discover that the major mistake they made was in letting the relationship go on beyond the good part. Comment on that?
I hear that a lot. I have a friend who was saying to me, I think that you should be able to renegotiate your marriage contract when your children go off to college.
Wow.
Because you're different people. Some people grow together and it really works for them. Other people don't. And staying in a bad marriage seems to me to serve no one's purpose. It just robs, especially if there are children, it robs your relationship of any kind of dignity, ultimately, because you behave in ways that are ghastly to each other. And it's demeaning. I think what oftentimes comes up is that the husband is replacing the wife for a younger version of herself and then will rather quickly remarry. And again, I think that gets to the fact that men really need women to be their intimate partners. And women don't need men as much as they need us.
Hmm. And I would say I would guess that the reason that this is now valid, the reason it's been the way it's been, is because women weren't in the workforce until 40 years ago, and it was in their best interest, or in all people's best interest, to stay in that relationship beyond what it should have been.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. Absolutely. We needed those stereotypes. We needed those roles to keep the women at home because it was a way to control them, and it was a way for men to wield all that power. Hmm. And that, you know, but women were invested in that too. They wanted to see their men as being all powerful and be taken care of. I think in part because a lot of them didn't believe they had that power, you know, they were happy, or, and again, don't mean to speak for everybody's experience, but I think that having your husband tell you who you were and to have that kind of security, it very much echoed the relationship at home growing up with a strong father. Mm-hmm. And the idea that women should be taken care of, that they can't take care of themselves, when in fact, women are great at taking care of themselves. A lot of it comes from actually believing that we have the power to do that and to not listen to the messages that the culture has given us, telling us who we are. We need to define who we are and own that. But that's not an easy process, especially when the culture is continually bombarding you with these are the five kinds of women you can be, right? You know, when you read even in the movies, men characters who are complicated are on the flip side. If women are complicated, they're considered, you know, to be harridans. They're bitchy. Hmm. Complexity in men is strength, and in women, it's a detriment. A man who has an affair in a book of literature, it's a subplot. A woman has an affair, it is the story because she's going to blow up her family. Hmm. There's a real double standard there.
Email from Kathy, who writes, I wonder if you have any sense of what the heck happens to married men and women at midlife. I'm a near 50-year-old good friend of many women. I have, as of late, found myself in many, many conversations with women whose husbands are straying from hooking up with old college days exes online to hooking up with a person through Craigslist. What the heck is going on? I'm dizzy with the sudden realization that long-lasting relationships are so fragile and that we women are so easy to fool. More than one of my friends actually said, you know, I wondered if he was having an affair, but then I thought, no, not Bob. How do we prepare our daughters for this?
Well, I think part of what we do is to not instill in them this idea that every relationship is built to last forever. I mean, that vow of, you know, till death do us part is romantic and it's lovely, but it may not be realistic. People outgrow each other. And, you know, that is different, of course, from straying. And I don't think that women want to believe their husbands are straying. And I don't think men want to believe that their wives are straying. You know, wives are straying too. They just don't tell. They're much better adulteresses than their husbands because they're so good at compartmentalizing. I think it is shocking for a lot of women that their husband, who, you know, they also see naked, could possibly leave them for another woman. It's, you know, they want to believe that you have bought into this idea of like the perfect marriage till death do us part in the same way that they have. I think that women then get panicked because they feel like, oh, my God, this is it for me. And it's not it for them. It's one part of their life, but it's very scary. No one wants to be left and no one is expecting this to happen. But it's not their fault. But of course, it is the woman's job to believe it's my fault. If I had been the perfect wife, if I had been the perfect lover, if I had been a better mother, none of this would have happened because it's my job to hold it all together. And that's rubbish. That is absolute rubbish.
Okay. We only have about a minute and a half left, but Alice in South Pine wanted to chime in here. Alice, welcome to the program.
Yes. Hello. Well, this is one of the best shows you've ever presented to us. Thank you so much. I just want to say I was having a long talk with, I'm 70 years old. I was having a long talk with my friend, my longtime friend Joyce this weekend, and she voiced a concern, which I have too, which is that, you know, women who are 40 and older have a tendency to just take the rights that they have for granted. And they don't seem to feel a fear that, or to realize that these rights are in danger of being taken away from them. And state legislatures all over the country, there, you know, laws are being passed to diminish our rights. And, you know, we worked very, very hard in the 60s. I moved from Raleigh, North Carolina in 1962, where I'd grown up, because I could see that the model of a woman, being a servant to the husband and the children was not the model I was going to follow, and I didn't, and I haven't. And I'm just very concerned, so I want to turn it back over to you because I want to know what you think about that, Alice.
I am very concerned, too. I teach undergraduates and I teach graduate students, and I have to say I find it alarming. I don't understand it. I really don't. They seem to think that there's no way that this could possibly happen. And when you point out, you know, Roe v. Wade wasn't that long ago, and, you know, women only got the vote, you know, not that long ago, I don't know what it comes from. I don't know if they expect that it's going to be some sort of Hollywood ending where, of course, everything is wrapped up in perfect,
there are more women in school today than men. More people are earning higher degrees. More women are earning higher degrees than men. The majority of the workforce for the first time in history is women. I have 10 seconds. Don't you think this is all about the change for women for the better?
Absolutely. I absolutely do. And I am hopeful. I am hopeful. Courage.
Alice, thank you for your call. Elisa Chappell, author of Blueprints for Building Better Girls and a contributing editor to Vanity Fair. Thank you for the hour.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.